Last day in the trustworthy stuff, so I thought we would do a little bit of review today. If you don't mind, I think we're going to just start with a little bit of prayer. Father, just pray that you would calm us and settle us and allow us to hear something. Actually, to hear exactly what you know that we need to hear. Help us to process, to consider openly. To just lay down the guards of our hearts and our minds and just set aside whatever we have going on in our lives to just be able to hear something from you that can encourage us, inspire us, if necessary, convict us. Help us to leave here different than when we came here. Amen. Everybody have a handout, everybody have a pen. Okay. All right, so a couple of things. We're just going to walk right through the first side of the first page. We've been in this now for 6 weeks. We took a break for 1 week. We've looked at a collection of qualities, we'll call them, that every human being, I believe, needs to possess if they want to excel at relationships. We said that every one of these qualities is in one way or another something that we see revealed to us about God in Scripture, and specifically how God relates to us because we're not always interested in relating to Him. So I assume that there's a few things that have occurred. If you've stuck it out for this long, it's either because you have nothing better to do on Saturday morning at 7:30 or because there's something that you've gotten out of this. So by now I hope there are two things that you know with certainty. Number one, that there's an area that you're weak of these six, because I believe every one of us is strong in one or another areas. Number two, that there is a specific relationship that is not working the way you'd hope that it would. Maybe you have some goals for this relationship. You'd like it to look a certain way, feel a certain way. There'd be certain interactions, and that's not happening. Maybe there's no interactions. Maybe whenever there is an interaction, you wish, in retrospect, that there hadn't been because they don't go well. So, with that in mind, the relationships that are most dysfunctional, but also with the thinking that over time some relationships deteriorate, right? If you're my age, if you're Jim's age, you've probably had relationships that at one time were good and have over the years soured. On the other hand, you might have had relationships that for a while were distant and there's been some improvement that's occurred. All right. So that's the first big thing. Some of us are good at one of these, some of us are good at another. I want to look at this next phrase. A phrase worth remembering, a lot of life gets used up in, and I think we'll just read through it. None of us wishes to burn through life always dealing with problems and always feeling ineffective in an effort. Each emotionally and intellectually healthy person wants to live a life expended in meaningful tasks and enjoyable experiences, which have high yield returns. Guilt, worry, self-condemnation, second-guessing, resentment, bitterness, uncontrolled anger. Each of these and more is a thief which will take life and use it up. Now, I don't know exactly what the interview was that I was listening to this week, and the woman being interviewed just said that phrase, a lot of life gets used up. You know, I don't even remember what she was talking about anymore. That phrase just stuck in my mind. I entered it into the notes that I was going to be using for this week. And I thought, wow, isn't that true? So here's a question for us to reflect on. Has any of your week gotten used up in something that you think back and you say, well, that really wasn't a productive use of my time? Has any of your emotional energy, has any of your thinking been used up this week in something that now you think back and you say, huh, there's some of my life gone, and it didn't go to any good purpose. It didn't go to anything good. And I think we can all say, yeah, that's true. Maybe some seasons we get more wrapped up in that than in others. Have you ever wasted an entire day fretting, stewing, being angry, upset about something? Or am I the only one? What good things happen while you're in that state?
No good.
I mean, are you at peak performance in the other things in your life? Let's just forget the one thing that you're fretting over and we'll assume, well, that's just a lost cause. Are you at peak performance in the other areas of your life at that time? Probably not.
Well, I just need a ditch dug. I might be okay. But that's just thoughtless manual labor.
Well, not only that, some of that anger could really be poured into that stubborn rock that just won't move, won't it?
So sometimes, yes, you know what I mean? But even while you're doing that, you're having the thought of whatever the situation is. It can tend to even ramp it up because now hopefully you spent enough time in the ditch to move past that and to reach it.
Yes, brother, you do spend a lot of time in the ditch when you're like that, whether it's a real one or a figurative one.
But hopefully enough time to reason it out and not just go back and make more of a mess. And you know, you can reason it out, God gets with you, and maybe you make a phone call in the ditch and say, man, she pissed me off this morning. Man, that grief grinds me up when he says that. Whatever that might be, you know, hopefully you can spend enough time, put enough, you know what I mean?
Now, look at the way Jim said it. I was going to ask a question, but Jim has already tipped his hand and revealed what his thinking is. When you find yourself in the moments of life that are consuming and using up your time, what's the loop that's playing? They're an idiot, or I don't seem to be able to? Because I think we all fall into one of those two tendencies. Either I never, or they always.
And which one uses more time?
I guess it depends on the person, but I think that we could be equally consumed. I'm not adequate enough. I didn't do this right. I have met with plenty of people in my life that were always down on themselves and didn't appreciate that the other person might have contributed to it and were always looking for how they could do something more. On the other hand, I've met with people and it was a 30-minute nonstop rant about how the other person needed to.
But with looking at yourself so oftentimes, for me, I'll quickly look at my part in whatever it is in the relationship. I'll look at my part quick, and then I can either, A, it is my fault, or B, it's not my fault. And if A, it is my fault, I quickly try to, I make the compliments that we talk about in our step, maybe step 8, 9, I make the compliments. But if not, now I gotta call somebody, make sure I'm not crazy. Someone else might go, no, they quickly go to, no, it's their fault and they're done. And they're still stuck. They're still stuck in a ditch. They should pass the looking at themselves.
All right, I'm going to put you on pause. He used a great phrase that we all use from time to time, and it's the whole reason for this series. He said, I quickly look through it and decide if it's my fault or if it's their fault. Now here's the thing, and this is actually the whole reason for this series. Is our separation from God God's fault?
Yeah.
So does God look at it and say, let's see, is it my fault? Well, I didn't do it. No, it's not my fault. It's their fault. Therefore, they got to fix it. That is the whole premise for this series, that is whether or not it is their fault or our fault, it is our responsibility if we choose to embrace it. That's the bigger thing. It is our responsibility, because what if they never get around to it? Hypothetically, well, it's not even a hypothetical because, again, we all know people like this. What if they never get around to discovering that it's their fault?
Well, what was the first broken relationship? The first broken relationship with Adam.
Right.
And so I'm sure right before Adam was like, it was that woman that you put in, he started blaming his dad. I'm sure God went, well, what did I do? No. He said, this is not his fault. You need to take a hard look at your kid.
So after we get past the, because I believe that is one of those, whose fault is this, is one of those life user uppers. I know I didn't phrase it correctly, but it really is. Now, for peace of mind, we might want to answer the question, have they contributed to the situation or is it all me? Have I contributed to the situation or is it all them? I mean, it's a legitimate question to ask, but at the end of the day, here's the question. And you've heard me say this so many times already, but I'll ask it the way my friend told me that his wife asked him. Do you want to be right or do you want to be married? That's flipped around in a different way is this question. Do you want to be right or do you want to be in relationship? Because sometimes you're going to have to adjust one to meet the expectations of the other. You can't always be right and be in great relationship. Right in the sense that you're going to defend your right to be right.
Yes. You can be right.
You can be right, but you don't insist on imposing your rightness on others and having them recognize your rightness. Because some of us, right now, as we sit here this morning, are still waiting for somebody else in our life to recognize our rightness.
Or you do this. Oh, you're right.
Which is anything but conceding that they are right. Okay, so several responses to human relationships. The first is, avoid the pain and the hassle and potential downsides of rich relationships by avoiding close connection and trust, and thereby never experiencing hurt, but also never experiencing good. So that is one legitimate approach to all of our relationships. If you ever heard someone who said, well, they got burned once in some sort of a relationship, so they'll never allow themselves to get close to anybody else?
Yeah. Anybody who's ever gotten divorced said, I'm going to do that again.
But they'll do it differently. Well, you would think...
Hopefully they'll do it differently.
And the question is, how will they do it differently? Will they do it wisely and differently, or will they just be a little bit more bitter and cynical? All people are like this. I have to keep my guard up because you can't trust anybody.
Say this, I'm on my third marriage. The first two were the same thing. Same thing. Disaster. Me and my big mouth, running my mouth, blah, 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 blah. Then me and crazy. Then I met Barbara. We did 40 Days of Purpose with Larry Wesley. Got saved. And I tell people, the reason that I've been married for 10 years without a fight, when I say without a fight, I mean I'm not kidding, not one fight, not one. Well, you blah, blah, blah. Never. In 10 years. The only difference? That. The only difference is that. We were both in recovery. We both came here. We both read out of this book. Come here on Wednesday nights. Learn how to be in a relationship. It's the only difference.
Well, here's another common response, and a lot of people are like this, too. Enter into a relationship naively expecting them to be generally easy and generally workable. In other words, whatever skills you bring to the relationship the day that you enter into it, that's enough, that's good enough, surely it can't be that hard. Right? And most of us have been blindsided at one time or another by the fact that the relationship becomes harder than we ever expected it to be. And sometimes it's not like immediately you discover that. How many of you have found an area of weakness only 5 or 10 years into some experience? Why? Because that thing has never been asked of you before. You only discover where you're weak when you're pressed to the limit, and therefore, if the degree of something that's being asked of you now has never been asked of you before, then you won't until that moment discover where you're weak. And you have a choice. See, because up until now, if everything that you've done until this point in your life has been easy, what does that tell you? Well, you've never tried anything difficult, but you've never exceeded your skill set. It's only when you get to the end of your skill set, your emotional intelligence, your intellectual ability to reason, all that, it's only when you get to the end of yourself that you discover your weakness. So if most of your life has been spent coasting and it's been relatively easy, it's not because you're great necessarily. It could just be because you've never been tested.
And there are those that are. They seemingly... It comes easy. Relationship comes easy to them.
We'll acknowledge that, but there are root causes for that too. Some of them are personality oriented. Some of them are just that they got good stuff put into them early on. Right? And they received the good stuff. So two kids grow up in the same household. One masters relationships as an adult, the other doesn't. Right? Haven't we watched kids grow up and go completely different ways? One receives something a certain way. One doesn't receive something a certain way. How many of us in this room would say we learn the easy way? How many of us learn the hard way? All right. Enter into relationships knowing that there will be difficulties and hassles, knowing that every party to a relationship brings skill level and expectation as well as limitations. Do you know? And I'm going to actually, we're going to go through a set of what I think are helpful steps in order to diagnose and improve relationships next. The people that are closest to you, do you know their strengths and do you know their weaknesses? I mean, not just what, if we were to borrow Jim's phrase, not just what pisses you off about them, but have you refined that into an understanding of where they're weak or where they might need help? And in a minute, we're going to look at a scripture that's going to be particularly helpful to us at that time. Here's another one. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Lisa Turkhurst, but I got this kind of an idea from her listening to something that she said one time. And she was describing it this way. She said, I had this friend that we were good friends for a while, but then she did some things that really irritated me. They just flat out really grated me. And she says, and I wasn't sure anymore if she was the kind of a friend that I wanted. And so I sort of distanced myself from her. And then as soon as I distanced myself from her, I realized the good things that she brought into my life that now I was missing. And she says, so now I was caught in this dilemma. I wanted the good things that my friend brought into my life. But the question, she said, was I willing to accept that there were some difficult things that would come with the relationship as well as the good things? Was I willing to accept that in order for my friend to be who she was, there would be some baggage that would come along with her, and if I wanted the good in my friend, I had to embrace the whole package? Or did I just want the good, and if I couldn't have just the good, then I'd just remove myself from the relationship? So that's a big question that we have to ask. Am I willing to embrace the junk that's with the person? The fact that they're difficult, they're moody, they're a little this, they're a little that. I'm sure every one of us has the blank that we need to fill in there. Am I willing to embrace that? Or do I just expect this to be a wholly upside relationship for me?
Yeah, there are those people that, I mean, there's a couple of different friends that you have. You have the guy who's skilled with his hands, and so he helps you out whenever you need to get something done on the house or on the car. You have that guy, you know, he's probably not really emotionally, you know, deep, you know, his
he doesn't have time to be because he has three other friends that also need his help fixing his car.
So we know who you are. But you have the guy who is, you know, emotionally, like, engaged, I'll call him Paul. He's engaged, and so when something's going on, you tend to call that guy. You know what I mean? Have the guy who can fix your computer, you know, and call that guy. And he might be a little engaged, but, you know, he's kind of really cerebral and, you know, things need to make sense to him. Like, there's a host of things. And I don't think, like you were talking earlier, I don't think any one of us has all of this stuff.
Mm-mm.
Nobody has all of this stuff. There was one, the yellow retreat. You know what I mean? So I just think that, you know, if we're willing, that's the key word here. If we're willing to look at, like, what we do and things we need for us to have, we are like, just like that. And I do that more now than I've ever done in my life, because before, I used to avoid you or put my hands on you. That's how my relationships work. And now, in my later years, with some wisdom and some genuine wisdom,
thanks,
you know what I mean? I've learned, it's a learned thing, to say, you know what, he's just like that. Don't worry about it. I mean, and just keep moving. And just, you know, I have to love the person. It doesn't change our relationship. I just know what I'm not going to get from him. We can still hang out.
It's a great introduction to the next point. I just know what I'm not going to get from him. All right. So, have you ever noticed this? So you've got a collection of relationships, a collection of friends, family, whatever. And they each bring something, but you feel somehow that something is missing. And then you meet this new person. And the new person has everything, whatever, maybe it's a friend or whatever, they have everything that you seem to need. And you think to yourself, now you never say this out loud because somehow you sense that it would be wrong. But you think to yourself, why couldn't this other person be like this new person that I've just met? Because they seem so nice and so easy and they understand me. Why couldn't the other people in my life be like this person? Now, am I the only person that has ever had that thought? Of course not. But nobody says that out loud. Because we sense somehow that that would make us bad or that would make us condemning or whatever. What's going on? Is it really that the new person has it all going on and that everybody else doesn't? Stop and think about what's going on there.
That's what causes divorce.
Well, saying that out loud is what causes divorce, yes.
No, but that letting that thought linger too long, unabated, is what causes divorce. And she's cool, she gets it, she's that, blah, 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 blah. Wait a minute. You don't even know her. And yet...
Right. That's it. What's going on? Here's what's going on. What do you want in life? In the broadest of senses, what do you want in life? What?
Just want to be happy.
Here's what I want. I want what I don't have. Do you want what you already have? And I know this sounds silly, but of course not, because why? You already have it, right. So what do you want? You only want what you don't have. What do you notice in the person that instantly seems to be compelling and attractive and interesting? They have the one thing that's missing, you think, in your life that you're attracted to, that you're drawn to. Now, does that mean that they have the full package? No, it's that's what Jim was saying. They don't have the full package. So somewhere along the line, you're going to meet the side of them that is deficient. How many of you going into a relationship brought your worst self to the party the first day? Don't ruin my illustration. Keep your hand down.
No, wait. On purpose.
Okay, on purpose.
But sometimes our worst self gets better. But that takes time. But when you show up, all your pecan feathers are out. You're trying to get...
Whatever it is, and it's not like we're not talking about the first time you show up at the bar looking for a date or something. I'm talking about in friendships, at church, with family, when you go to Christmas dinner at the in-laws' place that you'd really rather not be at. You know what I'm talking about. Do you bring your worst self or your best self? You always bring your best self, or at least you try.
You keep your mouth shut, you say hi, you're shaking his hand, you're very cordial, you're nice, not disrespectful at all.
Right.
I was thinking in terms of, I met my wife at billiards, and I wasn't worried about impressing her, I was impressing the guys I was with. Shooting pool with her was a bet from the other guys that I couldn't get her and her sister to shoot pool with us. I won the bet, but I've lost all my friends. Now, 10.5 years into my marriage, and I wouldn't trade that day for anything. But I showed up, and I did some cruel things.
And it seems it all worked out in the end.
Well, you brought your best to her. The relationship. You didn't worry about, you weren't worried about that relationship. The guys, they were there. But you were definitely bringing your A's to her sister so that you could get them to come play pool. But you're an idiot. What they did, good job.
All right.
You don't want to call her stupid and her sister fat and win her over.
You know the one thing about Jim, you never have to guess about what he's thinking, because within 30 seconds it's all right out there. Nothing more right now. We'll let you know. I think you might need to be ready to catch the board when it falls. Yeah, there's a limit to that. Okay, so here's the next thing I want us to look at. So we're going to, you've got the circular diagram there on your... Here's the big question. Which ones of these are primarily internal and which ones are external? What's that?
So I think this one is Chrissy's an a-hole.
Oh. That really would be a good clue, wouldn't it? Okay, you've brought more of your worst to the party. Seriously, stay home if you can't bring better than that. Here's how we can define this. Let me ask the question again. Which ones are internal? Which ones are external? And so a different way to look at this is, do people experience this quality in me when I reach out to them or when they reach out to me? So we'll look at it one at a time. Stable. So in other words, is this an internal quality that I need to work on the inside, or is this an external as in actions? Is it attitudes or actions? This is a different way of looking at it. Is stability primarily an attitudes issue on my part, or is it an actions issue? Okay, so you're saying that's both. So it is both attitude and action. How do we ever discover anything new if we don't interact with this and work it through? Okay, so what about approachability? How do people find out if you're approachable?
By nature of the word, that's an internal thing.
That's an internal thing, right. So it has to do with the matters of your heart and how you are going to respond when people come to you. It's the environment that you create for them once they enter your space. So we're going to say that's an attitude. All right, what about engagement? That should be easy.
That's action.
That's action. That's external. All right, what about love governance? Thoughts? I mean, you said that. Do you have something to back it up?
Someone who's love governed loves other people. Someone who's governed by love loves other people. You see it, and he even loves her. Really committed to her. Really committed to that. Man, he really loves that. Passion, defense. It would be like it. That I think love in general comes with the action.
Okay. Now Ron is saying
attitude.
Explain yourself.
The feeling you have inside and how you feel towards other people generally.
Okay.
Rather than specific.
Okay. I think love governed reveals itself through action, but there has to be some internal work. Okay, is there anybody that you would say that you are commanded to love, should love, that you don't feel a whole lot of love for?
Well, only because I was listening to Andy, and if you've ever listened to him, he said you've got to take a longer look in the mirror, and you've got to say to yourself, you know what? I don't like rich people. I don't like poor people. I don't like black people. I don't like white people. I'm commanded to love those people, but I don't like them.
Right.
And that's a hard thing. That's hard to be that gritty honest with yourself. And we're all supposed to say we got to love everybody.
But we all have that, whether we are aware of it consciously or not, we all have that. So you introduced the I don't like the black people, I don't like the white people thing. But do we know that? Consciously, do we know that? Are we aware of that? Or is that something that's just burning below the surface and we're not quite aware of it? And it's only at some catalytic moment where something tips the cup a little bit and we discover what's spilling out and we say, where did that come from? So it can take a lot of hard work. All right, what about the personal aspect? In other words, remaining connected even when it hurts is what we define that as.
I think personally, this person, it's one-on-one. Having to meet that person. Physically calling that person, physically engaging with that person,
I'm going to say that's more, my impression of it is that that's more an attitude, that's more something I have to work on the inside, because my connection to someone starts inside my... And finally, the holy and righteous part, I would say, well, no, I'm not going to say, what do you think? Remember what we said, holy is set apart to, we can only be set apart to so many things. So for every set apartness, for every slice of my life that I give to another human being, I have to be engaged there. I can only be holy to so many things.
But if holy and righteous, isn't that something that you see that? Because you see, man, that's righteous. He does the right thing no matter what, whether it's at home, whether it's at church, whether it's at work, man, he does the right thing no matter what. You watch it happen and you go, man, period when he was at home, he would be different than when he's at work. Or when he's at church, he would be different than when he's at work. So, same guy.
All right, so we might even be able to we'll put the R up here. We'll say that righteous is perhaps an external, that's an action. But what about the choice to be set apart to? That might be more internal.
Yeah.
The choice to remain set apart to. Were you going to say something?
Isn't it that because of one, we can be the other?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. All right. Moving to the, I think it is the back side of your page. So I know that probably most of you won't bother to do this, but it was my obligation to make this list, and it's your obligation then to go ahead and leave here today and ignore the list. All right? But if you are inclined to do this, and I know most people don't do the work that you people recommend that they do on the side, but here's the way it is. What I'm going to encourage you to do is when you have some time, take a little notepad, a legal pad, maybe one of those books like Ron carries around with him. Ron, hold your book up there so that everybody can see it. There you go. Excellent. One of those things, whatever they're called, books.
It came from Bob several years ago.
Okay. All right. One of those came from Bob several years ago books that you might have. All right. No... We won't call it a diary or a journal. We won't call it that because none of you would go buy it then. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that a lot of guys would just not identify with that. All right. Vinny, did you shave or something? I know this has nothing to do with... There's something different. Okay. Just don't do that anymore. All right, so... Start out by making a list of the most important relationships that you have. Allow a page for each. Now, for some of you, it might be 6 or 7 pages. If you have 10 pages, you might have too much to evaluate, and you might not evaluate it. So start small and then work out. Start with your closest relationships, maybe 2 or 3 relationships.
And if you're going to start with your family, hide it.
That's actually a good point. At least at first, you might want to do this. Yeah, this is personal work. Okay, and with all personal work, right? A little bit of effort will be required, a little bit of practice. You might not be real smooth about this at first.
And it's hard because if you're going to be honest, you might have to write down some things that she or they or whatever may not like if they saw it, which doesn't make it any less true.
All right. Now, the next thing. Then go through these 6 qualities and say, in relationship to this other person, how am I doing? Pick one person. Let's say you pick your spouse. How stable am I? Am I the same person in the morning and at night? Am I the same person on weekends and weekdays? Who are they going to meet? Because I think we're a little chameleon-like. I know that's uncomfortable to say, but we're a little chameleon-like. We're a little different with everybody. Right? And the reality is that the people that we get the closest to and the most comfortable with are probably the people that we're the most real with. Because after a while, we just stop trying. Right? Well, like we bring our best face to the party. But when you know the party is over... You know what I'm saying? When you know the party is over, then you start to be who you really are. Some of you are looking confused. Just think about that for a while and it will come to you. All right, so once you've established that, then pick one of the areas where you're weak and say, I think I'd like to work on this a little bit more. One of the ways that I've described this in the past is have some relational goals. What would it look like if you were to be a little bit more like this in that relationship? One of these things. And this is, I don't know, you might not like what you see. I suspect we won't like what we see if we're really honest about this. Well, there'll be some things that we're going to like, but there'll be other things that we won't like. Also, take an inventory of the other person. How are they doing in these areas? Okay, so we have to be honest. Remember what we said. You're not going to spend all of your life blaming the other person. You can't say, well, I'm not really stable because they're a lunatic when they're in the house and they force me to, right? The phrase, you made me. No, we're not saying that, but just identify where they're weak.
Well, from the beginning, why would you do that? Why would you want to identify where they're weak from the beginning of this whole conversation?
Because you need to know where you need to be stronger.
Or just to know what they don't have and are never going to give you.
And that's another
She's
good point.
She's never going to be able to give me this. She didn't get it as a child. She doesn't know how to feel like that. If let's just say, if a woman grew up without a father in her life, she doesn't take direction from men. Not that she doesn't take it well. She may not even take it at all. So you can't give her a suggestion or advice or direction. She doesn't take it well. So knowing that, you know how tender you have to be when it's time to advise. And not just go, well, why don't you just, ooh. Some can take direction, no problem. But you see where they're deficient. And then you know how to sort of, I don't want to say tiptoe around it, but to be more gentle in certain areas, because oftentimes as a guy, I just plow right in and, what have you done? What have you fixed? Nothing. I just want to talk.
Now, right there is a voice of wisdom. I don't say that a lot when I point in that direction, but... You okay, Jim?
I took my last drink of coffee because I got to go. But occasionally,
here's what I want us to pick up on that he said. Relationship skill means that I'm going to have to adapt myself to each person that I relate to. So if you're a father and you have a number of kids, every child is different. And therefore, you're going to have to relate to each child a little bit differently. It doesn't mean the core of who you are changes, but the techniques and the strategies that you use, the time of the day that you talk to someone, the way that you approach something, that's all skill and can improve with time. And that's why this list is important. You understand the weaknesses of the other person because you need to understand the skills that you need to develop if you are going to improve your connection with them. This is particularly important if there's some estrangedness in the relationship. I didn't say strangeness, I said estrangedness. All right. Now, here's where we start to move out from the inner work of the inner man and into the externals. So there's two things that I'd like you to do next. The one is, in a natural sort of a way, begin to affirm this other person in the area that you've identified where they're really great at. Okay, so let's say that they're particularly stable, and I'm going to use the word unflappable, that no matter what the situation, the kids are going nuts, maybe you flipped out, we'll just use your wife, maybe you've just flipped out, and yet she remains even keeled. So later on, at a moment where it doesn't look like you're gaming her and just trying to manipulate the situation, you'll just say, you know what, you're amazingly even keeled. I'm really amazed at how well you do that. Affirm people in their area of strength. But do it in ways that are natural. And don't make it overly flowery. Just however you normally are, be that guy when you do this. If it's the first time in your life you've ever complimented someone, it might feel a little unnatural. But other than that, it gets easier with time. All right. Here's the next one. So the first one was pretty easy. Affirm someone in their area of strength. Acknowledge an area where you need to improve a little bit to the other person. And you don't need to do these at the same time. Do them at different times. Take time doing this, okay? People smell a skunk from afar, okay? So don't make this look like you just got into some self-help kick and you've read a new book and you're going to take all the steps in the book and you're going to do them all in a week. Don't do this all at once. You have the rest of your life to do this. Work it through slowly. So maybe the next week you affirm them in an area where they're strong and you acknowledge that there's an area where you need to do some work and keep doing this. Now, if you do this for a while, I believe that there's the next phase that's going to start to happen. You'll be able, by by affirming them and acknowledging your weaknesses to facilitate a conversation where they're going to start to do the same thing. And what's going to happen then? Think it through. I'm going to tell you where you're doing well, and I'm also going to acknowledge where I'm doing poorly. What's going to happen if that starts to happen week after week after week? After a while, you're going to start to say, you know what, I didn't handle this well, and I'm not real good at this. I can't force that in you. I can't force you to confess your faults. But it will be easier and more natural for you to confess your deficiencies or talk about your deficiencies if I have gone first. This is what it means to be responsible in a relationship. All right, the last two. Develop a vocabulary around these things so that when you use certain words, the people in your household or the people that you relate to, they get it. And they start to understand this. In other words, share the concepts with other people. Share these concepts with the people you meet, the people in your family, and develop dialogue around it. Okay, a couple of verses that we're going to look at. And I think I'd actually like to ask you to turn to 1 Peter, and let's look at some of this together. So we're going to start at 1 Peter, the first chapter. We'll start at the third verse. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In His great mercy, He has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of salvation. Now, the whole book of 1 Peter is written to people that are going through persecution. Right, so these are words of affirmation, words of encouragement, words reminding these people of what awaits them, and also at the same time reminding them that they need to stay strong. Here is the good stuff that God has promised to you. So don't be discouraged while you have to go through some difficulty. And the way he words it is, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of salvation. In other words, here's what he's saying. It's not that God is going to shield you from all the difficulty, but God is going to shield your inner man and make sure that that connection between you and God is not broken. God is going to be your shield and protector in that way. All right, now, turn over to the verse. We're going to move ahead a little bit. Let's go to 13. Verse 13. Therefore, prepare your minds for action. Be self-controlled. Set your hope fully on the grace to be given you when Jesus Christ is revealed. It's an interesting verse. Therefore, prepare your minds for action. There are difficult things that are going to await you as soon as you walk out the door in the morning. Prepare your mind for action. Every good thing that you do is going to be preceded by some level of thinking or equipping of your mind that prepares you to do something good. When are you most patient? We've used this illustration before, but when are you most patient with people in traffic?
When they're just moving along.
Yes, okay. Well, there's nothing to be patient about then, Ron. When you're not in a hurry, okay, that's one. Yeah, that is actually good. Okay, so apparently none of you is actually really truly patient with people in traffic. Okay, Jason over here is patient with people because he doesn't have anywhere to go. He's not in a hurry, so he has no reason to be impatient. Ron said he's patient, I think, because there's no traffic on the road, or there is not, so there's nobody to be impatient toward. You're in front of everybody else, so they're not in your way.
I think okay. You're in the right state of mind. So like if you're starting to get out and the Bible says preparing, you know, if you're prayer or meditation or however you're starting to get, you're prepared and ready to go. If however, I'm sure I know I've done this personally, if you're getting up late and
and you're in a rush, you're like, oh man, I gotta get word something, and you're not prepared for the day, at that point, you're like, you need to get over so I can move out of it.
Sure. Now, remember what we said? Identify the areas where you're weakest in your relational skills. Those are the areas that you need to prepare yourself for. If you are naturally an impatient person, don't be surprised when your impatience reveals itself, but instead, in the morning, prepare yourself, or whenever you prepare yourself, do that. Whatever the quality is that you've identified here, this is the area that I need to do work, right? You are naturally going to do some things well. You don't have to spend a lot of time preparing yourself for that.
All right, I'll tell the truth. Never.
Oh, is that when you're patient? Okay, now you see how that works? I confess my faults, and then gradually Ron starts to confess his faults back to me. See, it all works. All right, we're going to jump down to verse 22. Now that you have purified yourselves by obeying the truth, so that you have sincere love for your brothers, love one another deeply from the heart. Now, when you read that, it sounds just like something that you would expect to read in the Bible, but it's really peculiar. So let's come back and actually read it closely and see if you can notice what's peculiar in it. Now that you have purified yourselves by obeying the truth so that you have sincere love for your brothers, love one another deeply from the heart. Anybody see anything odd in that?
He's differentiating between love one another deeply and doing it from the heart.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, he starts out by saying, now that you've purified your hearts and you are loving each other, love each other. Well, isn't that a little weird? If I am loving them, why do you need to double down on that? And Vinny's kind of onto it here. He's saying, there is a general attitude of love, but then he says, love one another deeply from the heart.
Well, having love for someone doesn't mean you actually make an effort to love them, to show them love.
Ah.
My notes for that verse say this, and I think this actually relates well. Peter exhorts his readers to love their brothers as those who are born again to the living and very word of God. So at that point, I would suggest that they're saying that we need to love each other as if they're already born into God's love, that God loves all of us.
What does it mean to love someone from the heart? So, do Hallmark moments come to mind? Okay. To understand this well, we've got to back up and we've got to answer this question. What is the heart? Now, we've talked about this dozens of times, so surely all of you should have a good answer. Holy cow. Did you hear that? Somebody actually remembered something I said. The heart is the seat of reason out of which we make our decisions. So now, what does it mean to love people from the heart? That we look into their lives, we reason, what could they use? What do they need? How could I be of service to them in this moment? And then we make a decision, reason first, what do they need? We decide then to act on behalf of what is best for them. So it's very conscious, it's very intentional, and it doesn't sound very emotional at all, does it? Isn't that amazing? Love one another deeply and from the heart. So go back to your book now, the book that you started, the what'd you call that book, Ron?
Notebook.
Oh, notebook. And that's not what you called it, Ron. Go to your notebook. And here's another tip. What is this person like? What does this person need? Where do they struggle and could use some help? Give yourself some pointers about how you could love intentionally from the heart. This other person. Turn over to 1 Peter 4:8. We'll go there. So I'm going to start at verse 7. The end of all things is near. Therefore, be clear-minded and self-controlled so that you can pray. So if you haven't gotten this already, it should be pretty evident that Peter thinks that a lot of spiritual life starts in the mind. A lot of spiritual life starts in the mind. Therefore, be clear-minded and self-controlled so that you can pray, and above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins. What's he saying? Now, he's talking to a community, remember. He's not talking to an individual. He's talking to a community. Okay. So we started out in the beginning here. We said that God, this is how he introduces it in the beginning, in the first chapter here. Who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation. So God's power, he says, is shielding all of us. It's providing an outer protection for all of us. But now he's saying to each of us that we need to love each other because love covers a multitude of sins. When you're angry with someone and frustrated with them, what's your natural tendency? To smack them, okay? Thanks for your candor. To avoid them or pull away from them. Now, what does he say? Love covers a multitude of sins. Love shields a multitude of sins. Does it mean that love hides the sin? No, it means that love hides the person. Okay? If the outside world is bringing attack against us, and you have to imagine, have you ever seen one of those movies where they have the Roman soldiers and they link shields and they create this almost impenetrable wall? Right? When I detach from you, which is exactly what was it you said, pull back or pull away? I separate myself from? Huh?
He said smack.
No, that was you. I remember that. When I detach my shield from your shield, that leaves somebody vulnerable. When everybody detaches from everybody else because of every slight, because of every offense, then every one of us in the community is left vulnerable to attack, and one at a time, we're picked off. Does that make sense? For the sake of community, for the sake of each other, and because I know that your shield may be the thing that's going to shield me later, I don't dare pull back from you. Even if you did just smack me.
I told my wife one time in an argument, she said, I don't understand. The old you would have acted out and hit a wall or went running somewhere. And I said, because the Bible says love covers a multitude of sin. And she said, you're calling me a sinner? Yep. I said, I value our relationship more than I do being right or wrong. And I can remember that our marriage changed because of that.
All right, one more verse from the Proverbs there. Hatred stirs up conflict, but love covers over all wrongs. And again, it's not saying that it dismisses the wrongdoing and it just ignores it. We're not pretending that, because we also know that problems left unaddressed just fester and rot, right? I mean, it's not like you are ignoring what the other person is doing, because when you pretend that what the other person is doing that is really wrong isn't bothering you, all you're doing is allowing bitterness to well up within you or indifference. So you're intentional about helping the other person to grow and improve or whatever else, but at the same time, you're not detaching from them because of every offense. Okay, so I said that I would introduce two final qualities. Well, I didn't say that yet, but I did say it in the email, which you may or may not have read, that goes out, that Jason sends out. So here they are. And you can see them on your little circular thing there. A tenacity of purpose, so that T in the center there is tenacity. And a humility in practice. So I'm going to go a little Easter story on you here. Hope you'll forgive me, but it seems to be the season of the year where that should be acceptable. So let's turn over to Luke Can I define tenacity? How about if we allow the scriptures to define it for us in just a few minutes? Would that work?
Yeah,
we could use dog with a bone
that
won't let go.
What?
Dog with a bone that won't let go.
Okay, there you go. Do you want to write that down, Vinny? A dog with a bone that won't let go. No, I really like his. That's good. All right. So we're going to go all the way back to Luke 9. I don't know why I said all the way back, but and I'm going to call this sequence of events the point of no return. And just so that you can start to look for it, here's the big idea. That Jesus has a mission, he understands what the mission is, but he has multiple points at which he could make a choice to pull back from mission. And so again and again, he seems to do things that commit him to the mission that he set out to do in advance of actually doing it. They become points beyond which he cannot reverse his decisions. As the time approached for him, and that's Jesus, to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. Anybody have a different word there besides resolutely? With a determined way. Yes. Anybody else? Okay.
Steadfastly.
Okay. That was a little bit of a delayed reaction, but that's good. So determined, steadfastly, resolutely. Now, look at what happens immediately. Okay. So he's up in the north, in his home area. He needs to make his way toward Jerusalem. He's got a time frame in mind. He already starts to understand some of what's going on. And so he wants to prepare the trip. And so he sends two people out ahead of him, or a few people ahead of him. And he says, and he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. Now, that doesn't mean much to us. But think about this. So here's Jesus. What's he heading to Jerusalem for? See, we know the story the way they didn't. What's he heading to Jerusalem for? In the biggest, broadest terms. Yeah, to give his life as a sacrifice, a permanent sacrifice for humanity. What's as soon as he has resolutely set his mind and his, some interpreter, some translation said, set his face like flint. Hard, sharp, and determined. Pointed in one direction. As soon as he is committed to do that, what's the first response of people? Well, if you're going to go there, don't go through my town. We want nothing to do with you. The first response to a commitment to act is rejection. Think about that. Not going through my town, you won't. Now, here's the tenacity of purpose in relationship. The first time you do the right thing in a relationship, it may not go well for you. The first time you reach out and attempt to do the right thing with a child that's not doing what you want, or maybe it's an adult child and they're not responding the way you'd hope. The first time that you do the right thing and you're convinced it's the right thing, you're convinced it's biblical, it's honoring to them, it's the right thing, they may reject you, what you do. Do you have enough resolve, enough tenacity of purpose to continue on doing the right thing even when the response that you get is rejection? Let's move on to the next verse. Let's go to John 12. In advance of that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move up and I'm going to actually ask that we start reading at verse 20. Now there were some Greeks among those who went up to worship at the feast, and they came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, with a request. Sir, they said, we would like to see Jesus. Now, incidentally, this is like an aside here. It doesn't have really much to do with what we're going to talk about. But why go to Philip instead of go directly to Jesus? Do you see a connection there? Do you see a possibility as to why they approach Philip? Yeah, exactly. He's Greek. So Philip is a Greek name, right? So we assume that Philip has some Greek background. Otherwise, it's not a Jewish name. So we assume that the Greek people go to somebody who they assume has some sort of Greek connection. It's kind of like going to someone in the same hood. Hey, can you hook me up with your bro Jesus over there? So that's pretty much what it's about. My hood speak is not very good, so I apologize.
I like
that you used that slang. Sir, they said, we would like to see Jesus. So Philip, being confident in himself, went to tell Andrew, right? He wasn't quite sure what to do with this. So he goes to Andrew. And then Andrew and Philip, in turn, told Jesus. All right, so the two of them go up to Jesus. And Jesus replied. Hey, don't you like the way Jesus... Why can't Jesus ever just give a straight answer? Hey, Jesus, there's some guys over here. They'd like to meet with you. And Jesus replies, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. What? Look, there's some guys over here. They want to meet you. Well, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Now, you can almost feel it. Yeah, but what about the guys that want to meet you? I know that's great, and I'm sure you'll do a great job teaching that later, but there's these guys over here. All right, now we look at that and we laugh and we think, is that really what's going on? But that's not really what's going on, because what's he saying in his own mind? What's he doing? This is another point of no return. What has Jesus' mission been for the last 3 years? Meet with people, talk to people, explain to people, answer people's questions, teach people, heal people, do all this other stuff. Doesn't it seem odd that people guy Jesus doesn't want to meet people? Think about that. What's he saying? I can settle for a lesser mission. I can continue to help people, or I can keep on with my main mission. And at this moment, his main mission, and he knows this, and they don't get this yet, his main mission is going to be extremely brutal and difficult, and everything in his humanity is saying, run away from this. And we don't talk about that enough. That's why I took us to the verse up there where he has to go through the Samaritan village. What was his choice? When he was as far away from Jerusalem as you could get and still be in Israel, he had a choice. I can either get out of Dodge completely and avoid this, or I can move toward Jerusalem. So as soon as he makes the move, I'm going to go in the direction that I know I need to go, even though it's painful. He's met with frustration. He's met with rejection. And yet, tenacity. He keeps on. He gets to here. The next temptation to avoid his primary mission is what? I can continue doing the good thing to help people, or I can do the great thing which only I can do. That's what this kernel of wheat thing is. So Jesus replied, the hour has come, the Son of Man to be glorified. I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. The man who loves his life will lose it, while the man who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. And here what he's saying is just a general principle, and he's actually applying it to himself. I will not achieve the thing that I aspire to most if I settle for a secondary thing. But now look at what he says. This is really revealing. Go down to verse 27. Now my heart is troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, it's for this very reason that I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. You know, to the degree that words can capture it, this is the closest that we get to seeing that Jesus really is agonizing over this and does not want to go through with this, but he feels compelled. This is his choice. He has to do this. So at the same time as he's torn between, I need to do this, boy, I don't want to do this. And we have to appreciate this. All right, let us go over to, let's see, we're staying in John 12. All right, let me just read this. Then Jesus cried out, "When a man believes in me, he does not believe in me only, but in the one who sent me. When he looks at me, he sees the one who sent me. I have come into the world as a light so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. As for the person who hears my words but does not keep them, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world but to save it." Interesting phrase. A man who completely understands his mission. He's not going to get distracted by anything else. My mission right now is to be the sacrifice for the world. My mission right now is not to decide whether people deserve the sacrifice. Because what is the general swirl of attitude around him at this point? Right? He's being criticized by religious leaders. He's been rejected by certain people. Everything about the environment in which Jesus is living right now in these moments could take him off mission. Let's bring this back to your relationships, your most difficult relationships. What would it be easy to do instead of doing the tough thing that you need to do in relationship? Yeah, it would be easy to walk away. Or easy to do, here's another. So that was the up in Galilee moment. Do I head toward the difficult thing or do I move away from it? Now we get closer. Have you ever been forced with, do I have the difficult conversation or do I have an easy conversation? Do I say the thing that I know needs to be said or do I say something less? We've all been there. And again, Jesus makes the right choice. I say the right thing, I say the difficult thing, even if it brings pain on me. And the evidence is pretty clear, right? At every step of the way, Jesus is met with another distraction or temptation to quit. This is why I say tenacity is critical to human relationships. You will not, in the short run, be rewarded when you do the right thing in a difficult relationship. Remember what we said about Joseph last week? Right? His reward for doing the right thing in Potiphar's house, his reward for doing the right thing was to get the wrong result. And if he would have interpreted that result and said, this is what I get for doing the right thing, I get thrown in jail. If he would have interpreted that, it would have altered the course of the rest of his life. Does that make sense? All right. Where do I have to go here? All right, now we go. Let's go over to Acts. I want you to see this. I really do. So remember the kernel of wheat thing. This is after the resurrection. This is after the ascension. Jesus' disciples turned apostles are now before the Sanhedrin. Let's just start at verse 33. When they heard this, they being the Sanhedrin, they were furious and wanted to put them to death. But a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law, who was honored by all the people, stood up in the Sanhedrin and ordered that the men be put outside for a little while. Then he addressed them, "Men of Israel, consider carefully what you intend to do to them. To these men. Some time ago, Thaddeus appeared claiming to be somebody. About 400 men rallied to him. He was killed and all his followers were dispersed. And it all came to nothing. After that, Judas the Galilean appeared in the days of the census and led a band of people." Okay, so Gamaliel goes through this whole group of people that had revolted in one way or another. They seemed to have caused trouble. And he says, but because they weren't from God and they weren't doing God's work, all their work came to nothing. So before you persecute or kill these followers of Jesus who are now spreading this teaching, think carefully about what you're going to do, because if it's not really God, it's not going to come to anything. And his speech, that is Gamaliel's, persuaded them, which is the Sanhedrin, this group of 72 people, and they called the apostles in and had them flogged. Okay, we missed that little part, flogged. We think, okay, they made it a little difficult for them, gave them a lecture, and then sent them on their way. It was not easy for them, okay? His speech persuaded them. They called the apostles in and had them flogged. Then they ordered them not to speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. Now let's just stop right there. What would your response be to being flogged for speaking out for Jesus? I'm not going to do that anymore. I did the right thing and I got a bad result. Remember the seed that Jesus planted? He said, unless this one kernel is planted and dies, it can't produce fruit in multiple people. Look at the next verse. The apostles left the Sanhedrin rejoicing because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. This is the same group of people that only a little while before had been scared for their lives and hid in an upper room after Jesus' death because they didn't want to be seen in public because they were in fear of their lives because since they were associated with Jesus, their lives might be threatened as well. The message of Jesus, the method of Jesus has taken hold, has taken root. The spirit that he promised has come into their lives and now they are the full head of wheat that has come out of the one kernel that went and died. And their willingness to endure the same kind of persecution is actually that full kernel of wheat in blossom. But how long did it take them to discover that? You see, Jesus knew ahead of time what was going to happen. He knew that the pain would produce a good result. When we go through the pain, here's the question. Are we confident that there's a good result on the other side? Because only a fool goes through pain with no good result on the other side. Right? Who wants to go through pain with no good result on the other side? One final thought, we're going to look at humility. Again, I'm going to use Easter story stuff. I hope you don't mind. We're going to go to John. We're going to go to the 13th chapter. You and I have read this story innumerable times, but I hope I'm going to shed some new light on this story today. It was just before the Passover feast, and Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and to go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. Now let's pause right there for a moment. So John is writing this. John is writing this decades and decades after this has taken place. But these things stay in his mind. The things that are written down are the things that have stuck in his mind. He says, having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. Place yourself in John's mind, sitting there in a reflective mode, going to be writing this stuff, and he stops and he thinks, if I knew what my fate was, in other words, he's placing himself in the mind of Jesus, if I knew what awaited me later that night and in the morning, would I be so interested in the people around me? And I think John is just amazed. He's not cranky, he's not irritable, he's not frustrated with the people closest to him. What's our natural tendency when things are going tough for us? Who knows that things are going difficultly for us?
People around us.
You bet they do, huh? Of course they do. And I think John is just dumbfounded by the fact that here is Jesus about to face an unimaginably difficult situation. And he's kind and compassionate and loving and actually goes out of his way to demonstrate love toward those closest to him. The evening meal was served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. There it is. Don't miss that. It was Jesus' choice again. Comes back to that tenacity. One more chance to bow out of this. God had put all things under his power. That means it was under his authority. It was under Jesus' authority at that moment yet to walk away from this whole thing and not do it. Don't miss that. And he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing and wrapped a towel around his waist. And after that he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him. And he came to Simon Peter and said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" And Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." If you have a Bible that you can underline things in, or if you have a device that you can highlight things in, I would like you to underline or highlight that. "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "Well, no," Peter said. "You shall never wash my feet." And Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." And then the Lord, Simon Peter replied, "Not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." And Jesus replied, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean." All right, let's go down to verse 12. "When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. 'Do you understand what I have done for you?' he asked them. 'You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set an example for you, that you should do as I have done.'" All right, now what's he talking about there? Because I believe this story gets so misinterpreted. Is this about washing feet? This has absolutely nothing to do with washing feet. And you know what the proof of it is? The line that I told you to underline. "You do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you will realize it." Do you know what that's about? What is Jesus saying is symbolically taking place? What he is about to do is going to wash people spiritually. It's going to allow them to be right with God. And so the resistance that Peter feels is just a small fraction of the resistance that Jesus knows that Peter is going to feel when just a day later, Peter is going to see Jesus hanging on a cross after he's seen him flogged. After he's seen him flogged to the point that he can't even carry the crossbeam the full way up the hill to get it to where he's going to be crucified, he has to watch Jesus be crucified, and he has to watch Jesus be crucified because, why? Because he's the sacrifice for his sins, for your sins, for my sins. This is the difficult thing that each of us has to personalize and accept. What Jesus did, he did for you. What Jesus did, he did for me. And our tendency is to say, "No, please do something less. You're not going to wash my feet." The interesting thing is, each of us is proud enough that we don't want someone else to have to suffer for our flaws. At that moment, Peter says, "No, you're too good to do this." And that's right. The challenging thing is for each of us to live with the knowledge that someone had to do something for us that we couldn't do for ourselves, and Peter had to sit there and watch it occur. You know why the gospel is easy for us? Because we don't have to watch it. We didn't have to see it. The reason that the gospel was powerful for them was because they did watch it, they did see it, and they did understand it later on. And Jesus knows this. That is what the foot washing thing is all about. The foot washing thing is about there is something that you need done for you that only I can do for you, and you are going to have to let me do it for you, even though it's the toughest thing that you're ever going to do in your life. And had Jesus not been humble enough to do that, then Peter's pride would have prevented him from receiving it. Now, let's make this relationally acceptable to what we're dealing with today in human relationships. Is there a degree of humility that you have to express in some relationship that is the only thing that is going to break down the barrier of the pride of the other person that is resisting it? Because who was at fault? Who was the sinner in this scenario? It was Peter. Okay, the other person in this relationship might be the one who is actually the one that is the stumbling block in the relationship. The only thing that is going to bring about a better outcome is your humility. In order to do something that you don't have to do, you shouldn't have to do, you don't deserve to have to be humbled like this, but you choose to for the sake of the relationship. And that's the amazing thing. With every option to escape this, Jesus chooses to walk into it. I'd like to tell you that I have a compelling and engaging ending for this, where I invite everybody to some dramatic call to action or something, but alas, I have none of that. This is what I have, and that is it. So, I think it's a good place to end.